This is a recording of the public hearing on coordinated communications held by the Federal Election Commission on March 2nd and 3rd, 2010. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
A special session of the Federal Election Commission will reconvene. We now have, we'll turn to our second panel. That panel consists of Sean Carencross on behalf of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, Jessica First on behalf of the National Republican Congressional Committee, Cleta Mitchell of Foley and Lardner, and Mike Trister on behalf of the Alliance for Justice. As with the prior panel, each witness has 5 minutes to make an opening statement. That system of lights in front of you should give you some sort of idea of where you are time-wise. When the green light starts flashing, you're within a minute, the yellow light within 30 seconds, and the red light means that the five-minute period is wrapped up. And then after that, we will again have a session of a round of questioning by the commissioners. So we will start with Mr. Carencross and then work our way across the panel. So Mr. Carencross, whenever you're ready, feel free to begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, members of the commission. On behalf of the NRSC, I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We have a keen interest in this rulemaking, and we have functioned under virtually mirror image coordinated communications regulations for some time, and hopefully our practical experience will be useful to the commission as well. I'll be brief this morning. I think that regardless of the challenges these coordinated communications regulations have faced in court, the commission has done a very commendable job thus far in trying to regulate here. This is a very difficult area. It is in the heart of the First Amendment, reaching political speech. Fortunately, as this litigation has advanced, so has the constitutional landscape touching on precisely what speech is subject to any regulation at all. And the very question that's bedeviled this rulemaking for so long, what speech outside of express advocacy may constitutionally or properly be swept into a coordinated expenditure regime, has been clarified. And it's been clarified both with respect to the actual content of that speech and the means available to the commission in order to determine the nature of that content. And the short answer to both of those questions has been not very much. In the words of Chief Justice Roberts, the motivation of a speaker is entirely irrelevant to determining constitutional questions. First Amendment freedoms need breathing space in order to survive. And I think it's important to remember here that speech that is not deemed coordinated is independent speech. And so a coordinated communications regulation that overreaches impinges upon precisely that speech which the Supreme Court has made clear may not be regulated. And so I think with that in mind, three guiding principles ought to operate on the Commission's work here. The first is content needs to be the touchstone of any new rule. That content should be defined. It should be clear so that speakers know precisely in advance whether their speech will be covered by these regulations or not. And any test that is post hoc determinative based on intent or effect upon the listener should not be adopted by the commission. Second, any rule should be narrowly tailored. And here I think that means two things. The first is the targeted communication should be made for the purpose of influencing a federal election as determined by the text of the ad. And second, then if it's coordinated through some action or conduct on the part of the parties. And third, in rationally separating election from non-election related speech, the commission should endeavor to side in favor of the speaker. And so before addressing content directly, I think a very important point needs to be made concerning an argument that floats in this context that's an attempt to dodge the constitutional reach of recent Supreme Court opinions. And that is, in short, that a candidate's mere asking for something in this context is alone enough to trigger a coordinated expenditure. And that, I think, is something that was considered in the past by the commission and was rightly rejected, but it fails for multiple reasons. First, it creates a there is no end to the scope of the regulation. Second, it turns an expenditure analysis, and after all, here we're talking about looking for a coordinated expenditure in the communications context into a contribution analysis, which flips the reasoning behind the regulation on its head. Third, it ignores the plain reading of the statute and the case law and the commission's prior statements that in this context related to speech, content is vital in making sure that regulation is reasonably related to a federal election. And fourth, it invites the very sort of litigation and investigation and process afterwards that the Supreme Court has ruled itself chills speech. And so an expenditure, as we know, is made for the purpose of influencing a federal election in the speech context. That means it is either express advocacy or its functional equivalent. Going beyond that would require reaching a standard that would survive strict scrutiny before the court that has never been done. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Karen Cross. Ms. First.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chair, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on this important matter. I'd prefer to let my comments speak for themselves rather than be redundant here and recreate them, but I do have a few principles that I hope can be helpful to you this afternoon. First, if anything is taken from our comments today, I hope it is to critical but perhaps general considerations that should assist you in creating this very important rulemaking. First, the commission must enact a clear, bright-line standard that will allow political actors to determine whether a communication will be subject to coordinated regulations. As first stated in Wisconsin Right to Life and reiterated in Citizens United, the First Amendment protections afforded to speakers require that we steer clear of the, quote, open-ended, rough and tumble of factors, which invites complex argument in a trial court and virtually inevitable appeal. If there's one thing I'm certain that my colleagues here today would all agree with, it is that we need to put an end to the virtually inevitable appeals of the coordinated regulations. In order to do this, the commission must craft an objective rule that focuses on the content of the communication rather than the intent of the speaker, the effect on the hearer, or the third party's ability to correctly guess as to whether its communication is subject to regulation because it is attacking, blaming, or criticizing, or exempt because it is instead offending, condemning, or disparaging. Second, the commission must ensure that any coordinated regulations issued are narrowly tailored and only restrict those communications that are both coordinated and made for the purpose of influencing a federal election. Let us return to basics for one moment. The Federal Election Campaign Act of 1971, as amended, essentially provided that when an expenditure is coordinated with a candidate, a contribution to that candidate results. The operative word there is expenditure, which the Act limits to, quote, any purchase, payment, distribution, loan, advance, deposit, or gift of money or anything of value made by any person for the purpose of influencing any election for federal office. Since BCRA, commissions, committees, and litigants alike have all struggled with defining what is meant by for the purpose of influencing any election for federal office, which has in turn made it incredibly difficult to craft coordinated regulations. But the party committees believe that Wisconsin Right to Life and Citizens United have set the standard, and now this commission is charged with upholding the decision of the nation's highest court. Unless a communication is both coordinated and susceptible of no other reasonable interpretation than advocating a clearly identified candidate's election or defeat, the communication may not be subject to restriction. It is with this general maxim in mind that the party committees support the Wisconsin Right to Life appeal to vote test as the content standard that should govern coordinated communications. In Citizens United, the court indicated that going beyond the standard raises serious constitutional questions, practically resulting in a prior restraint on speech. After Citizens United, it is exceedingly clear that ambiguous tests and 11-factor balancing tests produce an unacceptable and unconstitutional chilling effect. It is no longer constitutional to regulate speech absent an appeal to vote. Before I close, I would like to quickly acknowledge that the party committees are aware that the party committee coordinated regulations were not directly challenged in Shea's litigation, and further, that the proposed regulations will not directly affect the party committees at this time. However, we thought it was absolutely critical that our voices be heard with regard to this matter, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify. Each cycle, a different type of entity seems to surface as a major player in the political communications arena. While other persons or organizations, particularly active in previous cycles, may for some reason choose to sit out. This is not true for party committees. Political party committees will always be one of, if not the most, active participant in political communications, cycle to cycle. As Citizens United emphasized, the First Amendment requires the benefit of any doubt goes to protecting as opposed to stifling speech. We appreciate the opportunity to voice our opinion with regard to this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Verst. Ms. Mitchell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I was looking at the agenda of the people who had asked to testify and who had provided comments, and I, or at least had asked to testify, and I didn't see Mr. Shays. I didn't see Mr. Meehan. I don't see Common Cause or Democracy 21 here today, nor their counsel. It seems to me that that is worth noting that if these litigants keep taking the commission to court and complaining about the way the commission has decided to promulgate regulations based upon comments and hearings, that the very least they ought to do is to show up and tell you what it is they think you ought to do, rather than just waiting until after the fact. And I think that one of the things that's important and I would urge the commission to consider is that you ought to stop trying to put this toothpaste into the same old tube. Because, as my colleagues have said, the constitutional landscape has been clarified. And I think that it's important to follow the clear direction of the Supreme Court in the two cases cited by Ms. First and Mr. Cairncross, that in Citizens United and in the Wisconsin Right to Life case, the court has given the commission clear guidance, and you ought to follow it. And here are the things that I want to mention, just three things that I think are really important. Number one, the court made very clear that it is impermissible to treat media corporations differently than other kinds of corporations, that all corporations have First Amendment rights, and that those rights also extend to labor unions. And that means that when promulgating regulations, it is incumbent upon the commission to say, are we going to apply these regulations to the newspaper? Are we going to apply these regulations to the television station? And the court has been very clear that the First Amendment does not allow the government to license speakers differently. It is the right comes from the First Amendment, not from the Congress or even the commission. So it's important to use that standard. The example I use in my comments is that if a candidate walks into a newspaper editorial board and says, I'd like for you to endorse me, and subsequently that newspaper endorses the candidate and uses its corporate treasury funds to communicate that endorsement, that's under current law, that's exempt under current regulations. If, however, that same candidate goes to a citizens organization or to a corporation down the street or a labor union and says, I want you to please endorse me, and subsequently that corporation, whether it's a for-profit or a not-for-profit or a union, decides to endorse that candidate, that could be deemed a coordinated public communication. And what I would urge the commission to realize is to take to heart that every type of regulation that may be promulgated needs to be judged against a test of whether or not that same regulatory scheme can be applied to and is being applied to a media corporation, because the Supreme Court has said you cannot distinguish between the two. Secondly, as my colleagues have mentioned, you must articulate and promulgate bright line tests. Mr. Shays and Mr. Meehan and their ilk have not ever had to try to sit in a room with a group of people, citizens, who want to be involved in the process and to try to tell them what they can and cannot do. Because the more the commission tries to explain the regulations, the more difficult it is to understand what they mean. And so these bright line tests are really important. Objective standards that do not require massive discovery and investigation by the commission. Now, I was around when all of this began with the Christian Coalition case, and remember well such things as the commission's inquiry into whether or not Pat Robertson's prayer asking God's blessings for particular candidates constituted a coordinated communication. And I'm not making that up. It's in the case. And I know that the Shays Meehan crowd didn't like it because ultimately the Christian Coalition was exonerated, but we did get some law articulated. But they didn't like that, those guidelines. And so when they wrote BCRA, they didn't write new regulations or definitions of coordination. They just said that Congress was wiping out what the commission had already done and ordered the commission to articulate new regulations, which the commission has been trying to do ever since. But it's important to realize that we've gone back to basics, thank goodness, and you must articulate clear, simple regulations that do not require, frankly, a lawyer to be able to explain them to ordinary citizens who want to be involved in the process. And finally, two more quick points I want to make. One of the questions the commission raised in the supplemental notice was whether or not the commission should establish some higher threshold for filing complaints under the coordinated regulations. And I would say absolutely. I think if the commission would establish clear standards, clear objective standards of what is and is not a, what did the court call it, pre-arrangement or coordination. If the commission would establish very clearly, here's what is and here's what isn't coordination, and then require a complainant to have some actual evidence of violation of that clear standard, so that people cannot just basically write their names on a piece of paper and turn it in as a complaint, and the penalty is then the penalty is going through the process. So I think that that's a pretty good idea for the commission to take that into consideration. And finally, remember that whatever disclosure requirements, remember the court has left intact the disclosure requirements. We have to be able to know, is this an independent expenditure? Do we follow those disclosure requirements? Is it an electioneering communication? Which is it? And the commission must make that clear so that we can tell people which disclosure and disclaimer requirements they're obligated to follow. And I'll yield to questions at appropriate time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mitchell. Mr. Trister.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm here today on behalf of the Alliance for Justice, which is a coalition of civil rights, women's, environmental, consumer organizations that work to advance and protect the opportunity for nonprofit organizations to participate in various forms of advocacy. And our concern, which has been a long-running concern with the coordination regulations, is the extent to which those regulations might, under some circumstances, limit or make it more difficult to engage in legislative and other forms of advocacy. One of the things that I think is a bit unfortunate about both of the Shays appeal decisions is that while they talked a lot about the purpose of BCRA to limit soft money, they didn't talk at all about the purpose of the coordination provisions or the legislative history of the coordination provisions, which ultimately threw, as Ms. Mitchell described, threw it back in your lap. The fact is that the original BCRA and the legislation that was introduced had very far-ranging coordination provisions in them, in the statute. And there was a major uproar, actually, about those provisions. And the concern was that it would limit the ability of groups, individuals, to meet with their representatives, their senators, to discuss policy and legislation. And if you read, we've cited in our original set of comments a good deal of that legislative history. So what you have is when Congress sent it back to you, they also sent it back with a message, which is protect advocacy, protect legislative advocacy. And I think it's unfortunate that the court did not really focus on that part of the legislative history. Now, the question is, what the court did do in the second Shays case, I think, is first, as was said earlier, it clearly, as it did in the first case, approved a content standard. There had been some debate about that, whether or not the commission had authority even to write a content standard, whatever it might prove to be. And I think that both opinions were quite clear on the notion that you could, in fact, include a content standard in the regulations. And the second thing that I think is very clear in the second opinion is that the content standard outside of the 90 or 120-day periods does not need to be as restrictive as the content standard within those periods. And the court was very clear in approving that part of your regulation. They approved the fact that you had windows, and they approved the fact that there were different standards within them. They took issue with the precise standard that you used outside of the 90-120-day windows, namely limiting yourself to express advocacy. But they did not object to the notion of a less restrictive standard outside of the period than within the windows. And I think that's very critical for the job that you now face. So the question is, where do you go? Given what the court has said, which is limiting yourself to express advocacy is not sufficient, but you don't have to be as restrictive as the refer to test that applies within the windows. And we, as we've stated in our comments, support the appeal to vote test that is derived from the Wisconsin Right to Life decision. We reached that, however, in a different way than has been argued so far. There are those who argue, and you've heard that argument today, that essentially Wisconsin Right to Life sets a constitutional minimum that you can only regulate speech, which is express advocacy or its functional equivalent, under Wisconsin Right to Life. There are also those, I'm sure they've made them in their comments, who would argue that Wisconsin Right to Life is a case about independent speech, not coordinated speech, and therefore it doesn't satisfy or doesn't address the question that you're facing today. We reach the same result, however, not as a constitutional matter, but the Court of Appeals said you could adopt a reasonable standard in addition to express advocacy. And we think that standard is the standard in Wisconsin Right to Life. Not necessarily because it's constitutionally required, it may or may not be, but because it's a reasonable standard that goes beyond express advocacy, that the Supreme Court feels it used that standard in the Citizens United case when it looked at the movie Hillary and decided it was in fact the functional equivalent of express advocacy, and it has an objective standard there that can be applied. And we think the goals of what they were attempting to achieve in Wisconsin Right to Life are equally applicable in this context, namely coming up with a standard which will avoid endless litigation, that will distinguish between electoral activity on the one hand and non-electoral or other kinds of advocacy on the other. In other words, the court in Wisconsin Right to Life was engaged in a similar exercise trying to come up with a standard there, which we think works in this context as well. And I think that as a matter of law under the Administrative Procedure Act, which is what the Shays case is about, that standard would be sustained, in part because it was adopted by the Supreme Court itself. I don't think, and we've written extensively on this, that the PESO test, which you're also considering, meets those requirements. And we've gone into quite great detail why the PESO test will not work. Basically, it's overbroad. The commission itself has found in the past that the PESO test would include legislative advocacy within it. They said that in the electioneering and communication rulemaking in 2002. So we don't support the PESO test because we don't think it works. We think the Wisconsin Right to Life test is exactly the right formulation that should be applied. Thank you.
Thank you for those statements. We'll now open it up to questions from commissioners, and we'll start with Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to focus, everybody on this panel has said that they support the WRTL standard, the content standard. And so focusing on that, as we did in the last panel, and I'll remind everybody that the comment period is going to be reopened for an additional 10 business days. If you'd like to think about my question or anybody else's question and get back to us within 10 business days, that'd be perfectly appropriate and very useful. So the question is, the WRTL standard, as you know, that went out in the NPRM essentially tracks the language in WRTL and also in Citizens United. And so the question is, would it be helpful to anybody if we added additional factors to that test, whether it's part of 114.15, as one of the previous panelists suggested, or something completely different than that, but something that may provide people with a little bit more clarity, and as the three first panelists discussed, bright line tests with an objective standard. And one idea along those lines is one that Lynn Utrecht proposed in her comments, and she said the content standard should apply to those communications that contain express advocacy or are unambiguously related to an election because they make reference to a candidacy, voting, or an election. And another person on a previous panel said one idea might be to add something that made it clear that it was appeal to vote, a little bit more of a finer point on that. So I'm interested in everybody's thoughts on that question.
Sure. I think from our perspective, we would prefer the what we view as the Roberts test, which is the straightforward appeal to vote, without adopting additional guidelines, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is those sort of guidelines seem to have been viewed, well, have been viewed by the court. I mean, that 11-factor test was viewed dimly, and I think it was referred to as a practical prior restraint on speech. And so rather than setting a boundary within which if you cross a line, that speech is going to be subject to those to the coordinated restrictions, the appeal to vote test, which is very, very similar to an express advocacy test, it would be our concern, I think, that if you were to go beyond that, you would be going beyond the tenets of the holding itself.
I would agree, and I appreciated Ms. Utrecht's comments. I think what she stated was just to further strengthen the nexus to the appeal to vote and the election-related activity, and I think that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to avoid another 11-factor test, you know, as was criticized in Citizens United. I think anything that just further focuses us on the nexus to the election would be fine.
And if I could just cut in one more time, I took from this morning that there was a question concerning what serves to chill speech. And in my experience, we deal in a very practical world where people aren't interested in what the factors are, what the tests are, or the legal theory surrounding them. Can we act or can we not act? Are we going to get in trouble or aren't we going to get in trouble? And it's a pretty straightforward equation. If the answer is we don't know, we've got to run it through this balancing test and see where it comes out, it's unlikely that speech is going to be heard and proceed. It will be, in my experience, people won't speak. They'll hedge and trim.
And I might just say in response to your question, I can't urge you strongly enough to do what Lamar Alexander said to the president the other day, scrap it, start over, get a clean sheet of paper. Because the more you try to explain what you've promulgated previously, the harder it is to understand for normal people. And ultimately, that's who you're writing regulations for. Honestly, you're not writing them for Judge Kolar-Kotelly. You're never going to satisfy her until all of us stop participating. And that will make everybody happy on that particular side. But I just think it's really important to take a deep breath and look back and think about the entire panoply of the regulatory scheme and say, does this meet the test that the Supreme Court has articulated in these cases? All these regulations that were promulgated prior to these decisions, I think, have to be viewed anew against these very simple but important First Amendment principles and clarity and objectivity, bright lines, protecting, not chilling speech. I mean, that's a sea change. And so I would urge you not to start trying to put little maraschino cherries on top of this sundae, because underneath it is stuff that needs to be just cut out and thrown away.
We initially supported the 114.15 regulation as a way of spelling out what the appeal to vote means. After Justice Kennedy's treatment of those regulations in the Citizens United case, I think we backed away from that somewhat. We still support the appeal to vote test. The question is, are you going to spell out a detailed regulation that does add to the complexity, or are you going to leave it essentially? It's not that there's going to be case-by-case determinations. There will have to be. The court itself in Citizens United had to make a judgment and, in fact, applied some of the factors that are in your regulation in deciding that the movie was, in fact, the functional equivalent. So they're going to be, and you as a commission will have enforcement cases, and you'll have to make judgments, and you'll go beyond that. I think the question about the regulation is the regulation tends to take on a life of its own. And that's what I think is troublesome about a regulation that tries to spell out the factors. First of all, it becomes exclusive. If it's not in the factors, then you lose. And then you get into parsing what the factors mean instead of looking at each case and looking at the facts in the case and reaching a conclusion. And I think that you'll probably do, I would say you'd do better by essentially adopting subparagraph A of the regulation, which is the which states the appeal to vote test, as the court announced it in Wisconsin Right to Life and in Citizens United, but you don't go on beyond that. And I think we would favor that, although I appreciate the need for more guidance. I think it's really a question is, are we going to have a regulation, and are we going to fight about it, and are we going to sit it out there for litigation and let people take pot shots at it, or are you going to deal with it on a case-by-case basis? Because you're going to have to make judgments. There's no question about that. But the test is not so absolute that it just answers every case. You're going to have to make judgments, and you'll explain those judgments. But I think that, in my view at least, I think you're better off without all that complexity.
Just as a follow-up, Mr. Trister, to what you were just saying, I think you're right. The Supreme Court did, you know, use some different things and make a judgment. But my reading of page 8 of the opinion, even though they threw out some things that are in the regulation that's now been discredited, including qualifications, fitness for office, you know, her policies, all this kind of stuff, her Machiavellian nature, that's all tied in for me in the very next paragraph by saying the movie's consistent emphasis is on the relevance of these events to Senator Clinton's candidacy for president. So I appreciate what you're saying. You know, the regs take on a life of its own, but so do the words in the opinion. And we're just trying to put as much context into that as we can, if we even need to. But again, even though those terms are thrown out in the Supreme Court's opinion, it's all tied to her candidacy in the movie.
I think that's right. but I think that will be the case in almost all the cases that come before you as well. So that I don't think you're going to have cases where it's not clear that it's about the election. And I think that it's hard for me to think actually about how you could not fall within the appeal to vote test without having some reference to the fact that the individual being mentioned is a candidate, or that there's an upcoming election, or something that links it to the election. So I'm not sure that you need to spell that out. I think, to me, that's implicit in the standard itself.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I just want to note for the record that it's my understanding that Council for Democracy 21 was fully intending to be here today and asked to testify when we originally scheduled this hearing and when we changed the date in light of the need to get some further comment on Citizens United. He had a conflict with some litigation that he was involved in on the other side of the country, and I personally am not going to hold that against him. I want to compliment some of the panelists on their optimism. You know, a couple of you have said that, you know, you think if we adopt a particular standard, we can avoid litigation. Mr. Trister, in your comments, you say that, you know, if we adopt the standard as so understood, the court had no difficulty implying the appeal to vote test, and we believe the same would be true for the commission. I'm sure you've read some of our recent statements of reasons, and I, like I said, I appreciate your optimism. I from your mouth to God's ears is all I can say about that. Let me start with you, because you did change your position. You know, we had one witness earlier today who started out where you started out and stayed there. And you started out there, and now you've shifted. And you've talked a little bit about that. And I guess my question is for you, and I guess also for Mr. Cancross and Ms. First, who talked about the, you know, wanting to have these bright lines and how important that is would this give you those kinds of bright lines? Would this give you that kind of clarity that you need in advising your clients in interpreting whether ads are, you know, whether you feel comfortable running the ads that you want to run? Does it do it?
It doesn't do it as much as a magic words test. But I think you're between a rock and a hard place here. I mean, the court, that's what you wrote. And if you're asking me whether I'd prefer the regulation that the court threw out, yes, I would. But unfortunately, it did throw it out. And so the question is, how do we deal with the current situation in light of what the court said? And I think, frankly, there's only really two options on the table that I know of. One is Wisconsin Right to Life, and the other is PESO. Given a choice, I think the appeal to vote standard is a far more satisfactory standard, gives more clarity, far more clarity than PESO does. So it's preferable. It's not the best of all possible worlds, but I think that's not on the table, but, or because of the court, and I think that that's the difficulty. So it'll give some clarity. It'll be better than where we were with PESO. I think PESO leaves open much too much. I think one of the things about I think you have to take into account where the appeal to vote test comes from. It comes from a decision which was attempting to narrow. It was a case in which the Chief Justice was trying to narrow specific kinds of communications and say these were permissible, these were not. That's very different from PESO, which I think is moving in exactly the opposite direction. I think PESO is trying to broaden. It's trying to expand. So in that sense, I think Wisconsin Right to Life is a better standard because it will be interpreted, it needs to be interpreted in light of its genesis, where it comes from, what the court has said about it. And what the court when the court spoke in Wisconsin Right to Life about the need to avoid lengthy investigations and all of that, that's part of the standard. It's not written into the standard, but it's part of what that standard is intended to do. So we have some legislative history, if you will, or judicial history, trying to interpret it, which will give us the kind of clarity, at least more clarity, than the kind than anything else that we have available.
And I agree with that insofar as it's a standard that would be more acceptable likely to the coordinated regs when they go back to the court. But I just want to emphasize that the Wisconsin Right to Life standard, that appeal to vote standard, incorporates that, and I would call it something stronger than legislative or court history. It's a statement from the Supreme Court that this contextual searching post hoc is no longer acceptable. And sort of in layman's terms, I think of it as you're no longer judging a figure skating contest where the action takes place and you go determine what it means and whether the triple axel was hit or not. And it's more, this is a sprint. And you've got a stopwatch and the time's the time, and what it says on its face is what it says. So I think that when you view it in light of that and the actual holding itself, it makes a lot of sense to give us a way to give our clients clear guidance.
I'm not sure I followed your figure skating analogy, but okay.
That it's more subjective than a sprint. The judging of a figure skating performance is subjective with the judges as opposed to a sprint.
So the what we have before us are, we've got two examples, okay? We've got, you know, one set of ads from Wisconsin Right to Life that we know were not the functional equivalent of express advocacy, and we've got a movie and another set of ads in Hillary the Movie that we know are the functional equivalent of express advocacy. So I guess we've got two examples. Does that help to make it more clear? Because I agree with you, Mr. Trister. I think and it's part of my frustration that when we wrote that regulation, we tried to incorporate the factors that we heard the court talking about in Wisconsin Right to Life, and they said, don't write that down. And then they used the same factors again when they analyzed Hillary the Movie. So it's like they're saying, don't write them down, but this is what the factors are. Would you agree with that characterization?
Pretty much. You can't look at an individual case without applying factors. And I think there will be factors. I think lawyers who practice in the area have their own factors, their own guidelines for advising people. And you look
at something.
Is that
anything you want to suggest to us?
Well, some of them are in your regulations, and some of them are not. But I think you have a certain... you have to look at the thing and look at what it says and so on. I think the important part of Wisconsin Right to Life, you know, we keep using the shorthand appeal to vote,
right.
But the actual language of your regulation and also of the court is it's susceptible of no other interpretation, no other reasonable interpretation, but that's part of the appeal to vote standard. Certainly when I refer to it, I'm including those not susceptible part of it, and that's critical. That's I don't want to use the word presumption, but it tells you how to approach a close case, as does, you know, the tie goes to the speaker language. All of that is part of the content of that test because it's in the same opinion. It's Justice Roberts explaining what that means, and I think that's what does it. Now, you know, there will be more cases, individual cases, not necessarily challenges to your regulations. And I think that there will be understandings evolved as you proceed with them. It's a question of whether do you write them all down now and try to anticipate them, or do you deal with them on a case-by-case basis.
Which, of course, the court also frowns upon case-by-case determinations.
Well, not so much in this kind. I think that what they frowned upon was this endless litigation that probes into who said what to whom at what dinner party, and who said what to whom when they bumped into each other at some fundraiser. And that's the kind of investigation which we have to avoid under the coordination regulations. That's the value and the importance of the content standard. The content standard allows us to deal with cases at the RTB stage. It allows us to avoid the conduct part of the test by eliminating cases before they get into that kind of intrusive, nasty, endless kind of investigation. I've been through them. And I think that's the value of the test. It won't eliminate all of them, but I think it gives you as a commission and parties that are brought before the commission something to argue about and to talk about at the RTB stage before we get into the coordination, the conduct part of it.
Well,
if I might add for 1 second, when I first started my practice, I was given what I think to be a very wise piece of advice, was that I'm not paid or engaged by a client to say maybe, perhaps, I don't know, give it a try. I'm paid to say yes or no. You know, yes, that's permissible, no, that is not. And this is a hard area of the law, obviously. That's shown by the fact that we're still dealing with this many years later, there's no perhaps perfect, easy solution. However, I think that when you compare the two options we're faced with, you know, if I have to look at an ad and determine if there is an appeal to vote there, if there's a nexus to an election, that's much easier for me to decipher than to look down a laundry list of words and definitions and try to see if I think something's promoting, and perhaps if the person who's charged with reviewing that will also think it's promoting, and try to make a determination based on a list of factors as opposed to an appeal to vote.
And I would just say that I think that standard has an added benefit in that it eliminates the need to justify any sort of time frame. I think no one argues that the reason the time windows exist is to infuse some objective mechanism for separating election and non-election related speech. And so this solves that problem. It's a single standard. People understand it and can function under it. And it has the backing of the court to boot.
And speaking of individual cases, I will repeat the request that I made of the earlier panel, which is we put out a bunch of examples in the NPRM, which everybody ignored. But since this is the sort of decision that we have to make on a, you know, when the complaints come in, we have to decide, you know, RTB or not RTB. And we do it based on this kind of information, you know, What did they say in these ads? And some of them have, I mean, one panelist earlier said, well, it depends on the call to action, but some of them have ambiguous calls to action or no call to action. So to the extent that you all think this is a really easy test to apply, I'd be really interested in seeing you all apply it to this set of ads. And, you know, I think that might be illuminating to see if everybody comes to the same conclusions. No cheating, no coordinating out there. I really want to get your individual views on how these ads would play out. You know, if we, you know, adopt these regulations that you are asking us to adopt, suggesting that we adopt, how would they apply when we get these kinds of cases in? That would be, you know, you've got 10 days, and that would be very helpful to me to see what people have to say about specifics.
Well, it always comes back to what is the standard, and the objective standard should be such that most of the time, or 99% of the time, we would all agree that a particular communication either does or does not, or is not an appeal to vote. One of the things I go back to my criticism of Mr. Shays and Mr. Meehan is that they're not here, and they've never been here. And after BCRA passed, you'll notice that none of the sponsors agreed to come and appear before the commission. And if you read the depositions of the sponsors and asking them about different ads, is this a sham issue ad or is it a real election-related ad, they were all over the map. So that even the sponsors didn't agree. And it seems to me that that is why it is incumbent not upon us to tell you whether this does or doesn't what we think, but it should be a person of reasonable intelligence ought to be able to read the standard, apply the standard, and most of the time come to the same conclusion.
Well, that's part of the exercise. That's what I want to find out, is whether it actually does play out that way. And I'll just say that my own experience is that I went up to the Hill a number of years ago with one of my Republican colleagues, and we sat before a whole group of members and tried to explain these rules. And Marty Meehan did come to that meeting, and he stood up and he helped us out. And it was, you know, there were points where I didn't know what to say, and I said, well, maybe Congressman Meehan can help us out here. And he was very game, and he got up, and he was very helpful.
He should have done that on the record before the commission.
All right. Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I'm thinking of the right meeting, I think I was there.
I think you were.
I was, yes. I remember Congressman Meehan said that common vendors were okay. I remember distinctly he answered, oh, sure, they're fine, which makes me want to ask Mr. Trister a question. But before asking him a question, I want to say I really thought your comments were very helpful from a legislative perspective going through the history. Too often we forget that, notwithstanding what seemed to be a non-conferenced bill that passed, there is a lot of legislative history of earlier versions of McCain-Feingold and Shazmian. And it is significant that Congress did try to formulate a coordination rule but couldn't muster the votes to marshal a more restrictive standard. So it's been left to us. But I want to jump a little bit to another topic, which is about the common vendor, former employee. And I think your comments, as I read them, say we should just abandon the safe harbor. I assume that's because if we get the rule right, it ought to take care of itself. But let me ask you this question. Let's assume you have a person recently graduated from college, gets a job in Washington, D.C., works for, say, the Democratic Party, does that for a few months, but then realizes they're not making a lot of money, and decides they want to be more issue-driven, so they get a job with an outside organization, perhaps like your clients or maybe someone similarly situated, but a group that maybe does television ads. And let's say this group does independent expenditures. Now we know they can, regardless of what kind of money, so it's going to be more of that. You have an ad that's going to pass the content standard because it's an IE, right? It's going to express advocacy. You're going to have a former employee from a party committee working for that group. If a complaint is filed and we're confronted with whether or not there's reason to believe, I would think some would probably say there is. Is the answer then a full investigation and depose all these folks, or is there a more middle ground with some sort of safe harbor that might work?
Well, our comments, I think, on the common vendor and former employee provisions, I think, again, look to where you sit today in light of what the Court of Appeals has said to you. And again, you started with a rule that had an election cycle period, and then I thought quite reasonably narrowed that. And they said no. And what is troubling to me is that I think I wrote comments in 2003 when you were first, the commission was first considering a common vendor and other approach, and I said, I don't think you've got enough empirical evidence at that point to write a regulation. Now you're being told that you didn't have enough empirical evidence to change it from a regulation that you didn't have empirical evidence for in the first place. And so there's a very kind of circular kind of thing, and so I don't know what to do, actually, at this point. The requirements, what the court has said to you, seems to me to be setting you out on a mission which is going to fail. How do you distinguish between pulling data as opposed to a campaign plan, as distinct from, you know, what's the shelf life of polling data? What's the shelf life of something else? And are we going to have different rules for each different type of information and each different type of vendor? And it seems to me like you're not going to
be able to come up with the information. And the reason is I don't think it's a problem to begin with. I think that if we had a whole history of common vendor problems, the commission might be able to craft a rule that would deal with those problems. But you don't. There hasn't been that much. And we said that in 2003, and we still think it's true. So I don't know actually what to advise you. You've got a 120-day rule. They've said that doesn't work. That's not good enough. And they want a lot of empirical evidence, which I don't think is available. I don't think you're going to come up with that information. And so what do you do in that? And so my view is, don't have a rule that singles out common vendors. Treat it under the regular rule. Treat the same thing with former employees. Treat them under the regular rule, and we'll see what happens. And maybe, you know, maybe 10 years from now, you'll find out that that doesn't work, that you need a special rule for common vendors and common and former employees. But that was never explored. Mm-hmm. There was never an opportunity to see whether there was a need for that. Well, and I know none of you were on the commission back then, so I'm not blaming anybody personally. But I think that I think it was unfortunate, and I think, frankly, it was a misreading to some extent of what Congress said in 214 of BCRA when it said address these various issues, and it said common vendors. I think there was an understanding or a thought on the part of the commission that it had to come up with a common vendor rule. I don't read that legislative history, and I think the Shea's opinions now make that absolutely clear. Congress wasn't telling you to write a common vendor rule. It was telling you to think about a common vendor rule and decide what makes sense. And I think the right conclusion would have been not to have one, not to have a separate rule for common vendor.
Let me ask, open it to the other witnesses who may have some specific experience with this. Two folks from national parties, and Ms. Mitchell, who's represented national parties, a number of campaigns. Have you encountered situations where particularly junior staff people who may on paper, who you know don't have insider information but may be in the wrong place at the wrong time, have had trouble moving around during an election cycle? Maybe lawyers for outside groups say, no, you can't hire that person. Or have you encountered this issue?
Yes. We've encountered it both in terms of people who want to leave national party employment and go outside, and in terms of our being able to bring on a vendor or even junior staffers who have been outside and been, you know, have touched tangentially in some way a campaign. Yes, we have experienced that.
It seems to me that one of the problems comes about because the focus becomes on the employee or the vendor, the common employee, former employee, common vendor, rather than the communication itself. Because ultimately, it is this communication based upon prearrangement or coordination between the party paying for it and the source of the information? And so I think I come back to the content is important. The conduct standard should be very simple and clear and easy to understand. And what I think happens so many times is the idea, and I know we addressed this in the last set of rulemakings on the coordinated regulations, and that is, what do you do with a small company that's just a 2 or 3 person shop, and they make their living doing whether it's direct mail or media buys or fundraising, and they can't wall themselves off. But they're really not responsible they're not some nexus of taking information from this client and moving it over here to this client. I don't see that. What I see is people try to do the best they can for each individual client or customer, whether it's a party or the campaign committee. And you really, I know the commission has tried to address it, but it creates more problems and burdens than I think it solves, than there are problems to be solved.
Let me ask this, and let me offered this before I asked the question. I think the thinking originally with the concern over common vendors that Congress had was more the old model, where you would have a presidential campaign, a primary, you'd have a presumptive nominee, the campaign staff would leave the campaign, go work for the national committee, then may all of a sudden start doing issue ads or IEs or something that benefits the campaign. Then they go back and work for the campaign in the general. It seemed like you would take the information from the campaign, go to the outside, come back. Same could be for outside groups. That runs afoul of I think, anyone's version of a coordination rule nowadays. But it seems to me there's got to be a more narrow ground to reach that but not reach the hypothetical I came up with. And I guess the question is 120 days the right day? And if so, why? Because we don't, as Mr. Trister pointed out, we really don't have a lot of data on this. And, well, not only Mr. Trister, but the Shays 3 Court. So if we like 120 days, now's the chance to explain why that day works in political terms.
Well, we submitted comments and we supported the 120 days, but we didn't do so out of any belief that that is the end-all be-all number. We did so more out of a practical consideration that this is something we function under. People understand it. People adhere to it. And to your point, in some cases, it creates problems, and I believe on its own is capable of preventing individuals from speaking from time to time. If you have a group who's coordinating issue advocacy outside of the right now, outside of the time frame, and that vendor may want to be used by an IE unit within that window, that's going to create a problem for that vendor. And there are firewall issues. You know, you can create a firewall for that, but it's a in the case of
it's going to hurt the vendor's ability to earn money and yes, engage in a profession. That's tangible. Okay.
Pursue happiness.
Right. Okay.
And
any other concrete reasons?
No. And so I think if you change it, I think that makes sense to me that you would either subject it to the standard coordinated analysis or narrow it in some fashion. And at the very least, I think the definition of common vendor ought to be narrowed, because the information that's conveyed and held by media buyers or placement people or even fundraisers isn't the sort of creative, strategic information that's flowing to these communications that the regs are designed to prevent from flowing to the beneficiary.
Media buyers, you can just call the station and get the same information. Correct. They have, right? They don't really have anything that's not public. It just takes a little bit to get to it.
Correct.
Okay.
And same with fundraising, you know, because of your reports, that all is public information as well.
And what media buyers, as we all know, do is that they're really tracking the information that they're interested in for particular clients is what the opponent for that same race is buying. They're not coordinating with other campaigns. What they're focused on is this campaign or political party buy versus the opponent for that buy. And it's that is really, and I see it particularly with a lot of media buyers, that they're the ones who are adversely impacted in their ability to conduct their business because they might represent both candidates and party committees, and there's no information that they really make available to another that's useful, I don't think, for a coordinated public communication.
I think, if I may interject, I think one point that's important to remember is, you know, I think this idea that there exists some sort of big master plan or information that somebody could walk away with that would be relevant for, you know, any long period of time, over 120 days or otherwise, is sort of a myth. I mean, I would love to see that. You know, I feel like if I miss, you know, one particular meeting 1 week, the plan has completely changed from the next. I just think it's very difficult to make the case that information stays relevant that long. And if you were intending to be helpful in running an IE, that you could rely on information that you know, were last privy to 120 days earlier.
I think it depends on the nature of what you're doing, right? My hypothetical, which really isn't hypothetical, of a presidential campaign is a whole different worldview than your role helping a gazillion round number House campaigns, which always seem to be in flux. So it's tough to fashion a one-size-fits-all rule. Mr. Trister would probably say that's why you really don't need the bright line. But anything else on to justify the 120 days?
I think that the commission ought to seriously consider changing the shelf life rule for polls, because I don't think that, you know, 6 months, I think 6 months is way too long for a poll.
Why do you say that?
Well, because when that rule was written, it was decades ago, and we now have instant polling. Polling is done on a regular basis. We have 24-hour news and all of the various sources of information, and people are making decisions and learning about content and candidates and office holders, and, you know, it seems
plus
to me
polling has evolved, right? The old poll is done once in a while, but now you have brush fires, you have the roll, you have all kinds of things.
It's so many different
things. If anyone wants to elaborate on any of that jargon to put in the record how polling has evolved, maybe supplement your comments, because I'm out of time. But
well, the point is, when I say really take a deep breath and look at the regulations, I mean exactly that, because I think that the commission, come back into where I started, trying to put this toothpaste into the coordinated regulation too is maybe not going to be successful. I think it's important to take a breath and look back and say, you know, maybe we ought to look at the whole panoply of the regulatory scheme in light of these two cases. And one of them is, I mean, but there are all things like that. The regulations are full of these kinds of anomalies that no longer apply, and polling is one of them. When that was written, it was a whole different ball game. And I think the commission needs to spend some time looking at all of those kinds of things that are simply no longer relevant.
Certainly agree, but we can't do that today. And
no, not today. But
certainly. I don't think I can do much more. I've already taken up enough time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther.
Thanks very much. The frustration that is increasing here on my part is the fact that we really can't get any guidance on vendor, for example. What factors should we consider? We have to adopt a rule, and it's a struggle. There's very little empirical evidence that exists now that we didn't have then, and so I'm not too sure whether we just substitute one arbitrary standard for another, and to see if maybe we strike some lucky day that the court will approve. But are there any particular factors, if you were sitting in our position, that would
I would say only that like I said earlier, our support of 120 days was simply because that's what's existed till now, and people have become somewhat accustomed to functioning under it. It's almost that's not a justification or an explanation that's going to be helpful for the court, but you know, the information, the value of the information that is held by those consultants to survive 120 days and still be relevant, I'm sure there is some piece of information perhaps that's out there. I don't know precisely what that would be. It would be very valuable. And so I think if you act to change that, I think narrowing that window significantly would be a helpful thing, and that alone may be able to justify that on the basis of the value of information and the speed at which campaigns move today.
Narrowing the window being reduce the time?
To reduce the time, to shrink the time from 120 days into some, and I have no basis for suggesting a particular number, but 120 days is a lengthy period of time, and there is virtually no relevant campaign strategic information that's going to survive 60 days, much less 120 days.
Aren't there times, though, like in a presidential campaign, where people start to look seriously at how they're going to conduct the whole campaign, not just the message from day, you know, and certainly, I guess, for any election, too, but start making plans right away, and they may include some plans that don't necessarily have a risk of being modified to the point where there may be some strategic plans about how to approach getting electoral votes. I mean, like, look at Obama, and he went out and picked off all those small states, and that was something people hadn't really done before. And if that became well known, and maybe it was well known, it just wasn't well implemented. But there are things out there that, or if you know something, which is a major weakness of your candidate that you hope doesn't come out, but you're strategizing for it right now, or a major attack on another candidate that you know because you know a major weakness, but you're not going to disclose it until later.
Well, let's use the specific example. In 08, the Reverend Wright issue became a very hot-button issue all of a sudden. And if you had consultants who were consulting and in on conversations the week where that was developing as an issue, and then you took 120 days later and they were to act on whatever those conversations were, I would guess that the people involved in that campaign would be extremely nervous about what they were going to be saying and communicating 120 days from now. And that strategy, whether or not that's a weakness or and that's just one scenario out of hundreds, changes day in and day out. And so there may be a case where there's some silver bullet. You know, campaigns are always people are always hunting for them, and they never seem to exist. That's out there, that's super secret and held. But I think in the grand scheme of things, that very little of that information is still relevant, and whatever discussion was had at that period of time is just going to be obsolete and at least an equal chance of being counterproductive. And again, this all takes place in a context of giving the tie toward toward speaking. The endeavor should be slanted in favor of people working to produce speech rather than restricting that flow.
I think that in answer to your question, though, another, we just go through the list of potential former employees and common vendors. I think the commission is obligated to establish what's the problem you're trying to solve. What's the problem of the media buyer? What's the problem of, I mean, ultimately it comes back to, is this public communication something that this speaker is paying for that was made with the basis of pre-arrangement? And I think that if you keep it narrow, the conduct narrow, it will help you narrow the scope of potential problems. I don't see the problems with common vendors. The thing that is interesting to me is, I mean, I don't think Harold Ickes needs to be a common vendor with anybody or consultant to know exactly what it is he wants to do with any outside organization. And I think that's true for, I represent a lot of outside organizations. They know what they want to talk about, and sometimes it is the exact opposite of what the candidates want to talk about. And I have had my campaign clients say, I wish my friends would quit saying these things. So I think that there's a lot of fear about things that I frankly don't think there's a lot of empirical evidence to support regulating a problem that, to my way of thinking and my observation, is really not a problem.
Let's see. There's two more. Yeah. I just want to say that while it's easy to say for us to adopt a WRCL, or Wisconsin Right to Life approach, I guarantee you that there will be a number of lawyers before us trying to discern exactly what reasonable means, like the reasonable man standard we learned about in torts. What's reasonable and what's not susceptible of another meaning, or whether it's an appeal to vote. And that's why I think, Commissioner Weintraub is saying, do you want to get some clarity on that, or do you want to just sit there and see, are examples helpful? Are there other ones? Are they inconsistent? I know some people said they're inconsistent. We'd take any advice you have on how to implement that, if that in fact is what we decide to do.
How about going back?
And likewise, whether it's PASO or not, Do you find it better to see examples in regulations just in the E&J, instead of that, a safe harbor, or a more defined defining what reasonable man is to a reasonable person in susceptible of belief? Because I think, like in Hillary, they said most of the people would agree. What does that mean for us now?
Well, I don't know that there would be any. I think the commission ought to seriously consider going back to the Buckley test, because the Buckley court said people have a right to know before they speak what speech is regulated and what speech isn't. And I know that we've come almost full circle, but we're not quite full circle yet, but I think the commission ought to seriously consider that. People can make fun of and denigrate the magic words, but there's a reason that they're magic words, because then you know, if I don't say this, and I don't say this, I don't say this, 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 or this, I can talk, and the government can't come after me. I think that's what the First Amendment requires, but maybe I'm too simple.
Well, I think the problem is that we're faced with people who come in with different iterations of those bright lines, and we find ourselves getting them more blurry than bright sometimes.
I understand that, but I think that maybe one of the things those of us who, after we finish testifying, writing comments, go back to our day jobs and sort of leave the field to the people who spend full time trying to boss other people around and tell them what they can and can't say, that maybe we have an obligation to try to do some things. Maybe we ought to file some lawsuits and say that these regulations violate the First Amendment, do some things that, you know, maybe try to help you out a little bit.
But also with respect to the standard, if I could, I think it's helpful to view, I mean, it's not, you're not deciding in a vacuum. That is to say, the PASO test, for example, which I think is unacceptable and faulty for numerous reasons, but I took from this morning's conversation that even its advocates have a very difficult time identifying what is and what isn't. And to some degree, I think that it's an irrelevant question under that test, because really what it means is, well, if you hit the conduct standard, we'll find a way for it to meet PASO. Everything can be if the conduct is falls within this range is PASO. And I think that reverses the direction that the commission needs to go in, which is establishing that expenditure on the front end. And in the case of an expenditure, which is what we're talking about coordinated expenditures here, that test, going back to Buckley, was talking in terms of express advocacy. And even if I recall it correctly, the footnote in Buckley that touched on coordinated communications involved a billboard expressly advocating a call to action, vote for or elect the candidate. I don't remember precisely. I apologize. But that's the framework that I think the commission should be working in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. I want to focus a few questions on the potential impact that this rule will have on grassroots organizations that both lobby directly on Capitol Hill and also engage in what we call grassroots lobbying in terms of actually running ads to try to influence legislative debates. And if I can start with you, Mr. Trister, I was looking on your organization's website and just looking at the vast array of interests that are represented underneath the umbrella of the Alliance for Justice. I mean, everything from environmental groups, groups that deal with judicial nominations, workers' rights, healthcare. I mean, there's hardly an issue that is considered by Congress and in the midst of our larger legislative debates that isn't covered by one of the organizations in your group. And did you happen to be here for this morning's panel and the discussion
no,
about
wasn't.
PASO? Okay. The question I have is about if we had. Because this rule is obviously going to have a very large impact on those groups and their ability to engage in grassroots lobbying. Under a PASO standard, as it was articulated and defended on the earlier panel, PASO would seem to encompass not only a large amount, maybe it would capture a large maybe all election-related speech, but it would seem to also capture a large amount of non-election-related speech. The courts in Shays 3 clearly contemplated that there's a difference between election-related speech and non-election-related speech, and we just needed to develop a standard that rationally separated the two. It's not going to be perfect, but it needs to be close enough. Would a PASO standard actually not rationally separate, but basically leave very little left in the non-election related universe and basically sweep in most and make it election related, even if the way in which your groups operate, it by no means is election related in the sense that your groups are going up and actually trying to influence legislative issues?
Well, I think the problem with the PASO test is that, first, we're not sure what it means, but it is overbroad because it uses words like support or promote or attack or oppose. And to me, what that means is if you say something nice or you say something negative about a candidate, you've promoted or attacked. You don't know. And yet you might want to be saying those things exactly in the context of a legislative effort. An example is it's not uncommon amongst groups that are active on legislation when a key vote is taken to want to thank members who came with them publicly in ads. And they say, thank you for your vote on the energy bill, or thank you for your vote on that bill, or whatever. Now, does that support them or promote them? I'm afraid it does, because it's a positive statement about the person you're talking about. Yet it's all done for legislative reasons. It's done because you know that that person's going to have to make a vote on the same bill when it comes back from conference, or if it doesn't pass this year, it's going to be back next year. And so you're trying to build and reward the people who have been with you on tough votes, and you want to be able to do that. Now, from the PASO test, I think, and most people that I've talked to think, that is prohibited under that test. It would be swept under that test if you coordinated. And that's the problem. The other part of the problem is that these groups are regularly meeting with people on the Hill. Right. Now, they may or may not be talking about the ads that they're going to run, but they can't afford an investigation into what they said. They need a test that stops the thing in its tracks. They need a test that says if a complaint is filed, when they file an ad, they run an ad of the kind that I just described, they need to be able to say, that's not covered. So you don't come into and start deposing every one of our lobbyists to find out who they met with on the Hill and what they said to them and where they went for dinner and did they see them at a Saturday night dinner party. And that's what coordination is about when you get to the content standard. So you need something that filters that out, or groups are going to be afraid to talk to members of Congress, or they're not going to run the ads. It's one or the other. And it's not a question of whether they will ultimately win. It's a question of having to go through an investigation like that. That in itself is the deterrent. And I think that that's the problem. So I think PASO is going to pick up in a lot more and therefore open up more and more investigations.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, under a PASO standard, grassroots lobbying and regular kind of normal legislative grassroots lobbying that may have some incidental impact on elections, but as I read the statute doesn't say an expenditure may have an incidental, spending that has an incidental impact. It says spending that has the, for the purpose of influencing an election. But you're saying that under a PASO standard, all sorts of communications that truly are intended for having an impact on the legislative process would now be swept within the umbrella of being considered election-related speech, which would could trigger all sorts of investigations.
Let me give you another example.
And would it be fair to say that that would then, and I think I heard you say this, would that be fair to say that that would chill your organizations in terms of the sort of speech that they would engage in?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the thank you ads are one. Another version would be, supposing you've got a piece of legislation coming up and some members have come out against it, and you want to change their position. So you say, so-and-so wants to do such-and-such, and we don't agree with it. We think it's a bad thing. He's going to vote against such-and-such a bill. Is that an attack? It sounds like an attack to me. It's an attack for legislative reasons. It's not an attack for electoral reasons. And yet it's an attack, and that's what the word is in peso. So that the problem is that so much that you want to do as a grassroots communication is going to be swept up in peso. It's overbroad to the extent that we can understand it at all.
And I think, I think you've hit the nail on the head where I don't think you even have to determine the degree to which that extra speech is swept in there, because it's going to chill speech so much that, you know, if you aren't sure if it's going to be okay, you're not going to speak. I mean, people are trying to comply, and I think that's exactly what the First Amendment was designed to protect against.
Ms. Mitchell, I saw you nodding your head, and I should clarify at the beginning that you've also represented many grassroots organizations.
Yes,
and many that engage in both direct lobbying and that have engaged in independent speech for all sorts of interests. So this is something that's somewhat in your wheelhouse.
Very near and dear to my heart. And one of the things that's troublesome is, again, going back to the genesis of this notion in the first place, to go beyond regulating express advocacy communications and to call every radio and television advertisement within so many days of a primary or so many days of a general, to refer to that by definition as electioneering has always been offensive to me, because it subjects still the speaker to disclosures and disclaimers when in fact it may have nothing to do with the election. But by law, the statute has converted First Amendment protected lobbying to disclosable and reportable electioneering. They're both protected under the First Amendment, but the statute presupposes that is intended to influence the election. And I go back to Buckley. One of the things the court said was you can't neatly separate elections and legislation and public policy. I mean, they're all tied together. That is, after all, what a democracy is about. And I see so many organizations who are subject to, because of a time period, I mean, we don't know how long this health care debate is going to go on. We're starting to get into primary periods. We're starting to get into caucuses and conventions that are going to nominate candidates all spring. And now, all of a sudden, organizations that are out there who don't really care and don't really do election-related things, but they do lobbying and they do grassroots lobbying, and they're determined they're going to get those blue dogs to know we need you to vote this way or that way. And now they're going to all have to report as though they're electioneering. And I think that's really offensive. But that is what the authors of the legislation wanted. They do want, and I've seen the comments, they do believe, the people who have sued you before and will probably be back at the courthouse again as soon as the ink is dry on these regulations, whatever you write, they believe that all communications paid for by outside groups, I've always thought that was an interesting term, outside groups, outside of what, pray tell, but that any communications that they make, if they reference candidates or office holders year in, year out, should be subject to disclosure and regulation by the commission. I think that that's a very broad and impermissible type of approach. So, yes, I see this all the time, and I think that it's really problematic. But it starts with presuming that every time you communicate about an office holder that somehow you're trying to influence the election. That is not the case.
Thank you. Just, I guess, one last final point is, as we've been engaging in this rulemaking, obviously we have to meet the instructions of the Shays 3 court, what Judge Tatel set forward, saying that we just can't use express advocacy outside the relevant windows. But it seems like as we're going forward, we not only need to be concerned about, is it safe to say we shouldn't be concerned just about what we need to do in order to meet the court's instruction, but we also have to be careful that in trying to meet that, we don't unnecessarily walk right into a constitutional buzzsaw and create a standard that could then subject us to further litigation for again chilling too much speech that clearly doesn't have a nexus to the election. Would you say that that's safe to say that we need to keep both interests in mind as we're going forward on this regulation?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. In fact, I think that the commission is obligated to act in terms of preserving the First Amendment rights have been highlighted by the court.
All right. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to return to the topic of vendors, and I do so with some trepidation. But let me be clear. I want to narrow this conversation just a little bit because we noticed a couple of alternatives. And while the original rule may have been not well-founded and perhaps there might be some other places to draw lines with respect to certain types of vendors, we have an alternative before us. And so I'd like to focus on whether we think that alternative, we can justify that alternative in response to what the court has said, which was basically we didn't provide an explanation as to why the 120 days is relevant with respect to all of the campaign information that would be material. And thus, if it were used by a former employer or a common vendor, in the court's view, could result in coordination that would go unregulated. So that's sort of where we are. And I really appreciate the party committee's response on this topic and elaboration of what I think you've called the diminishing relevance of data. So there, I just have a couple of more questions I'd like to flesh out, if I might. Because I think there's a couple of important points, and Ms. First, you raised one of them. Some data becomes public after, you know, at least some give or take 90 days. There's a filing report from a campaign that tells us what donors are filed with us. We put it on the web. I think that would be hard to argue that isn't in the public domain in a way that would make it difficult to say that a former employee's possession of that information would be any way different than anyone else in the public domain's ability to use that data. I think the 120 days, and this is where I'd like your view, is sufficient to cover something like donor information, that we could say safely that after 120 days, that data doesn't retain any relevance, as you've used that term.
We've discussed, I just don't think the empirical evidence that we're looking for here, you know, perhaps exists. It would be wonderful if it does. I can say that.
I don't know that, I think you're right. We might not have a massive study that tells us this because there are a number of different types of data, a number of different vendors and employees at issue here. But I'm not sure that the court said that we needed empirical data versus an explanation for why this is a sufficient time frame. So mm-hmm. We did have empirical data in setting another window, the other windows. As I read the court, it wasn't saying we needed empirical data, a massive study to explain why this is the right line.
It's an explanation.
I think an explanation, particularly from people who are engaged in this conduct and who would know best sure. when this information becomes less irrelevant or stale or public sure. seems to me to be something that we could provide the court with as a justification.
Well, we supported the 120 days, and we certainly support that over something broader. I look at it this way. Would I be comfortable if I were sitting on a campaign, directing that campaign, having an employee, then sending that employee away for 4 months, and then expecting them to walk back in and know exactly what needs to be done, what should be said, what ads should be run, you know, what events held where, in order to ensure the success of our campaign? Absolutely not. That's absurd. I think the time period, 120 days, can certainly be lowered. I think with the advent of the internet, Twitter, for instance, I mean, things are literally happening instantaneously. So I think to assume that someone who's interested in helping or hurting a candidate by knowing a piece of information that is exactly relevant and exactly what is necessary. After 120 days of sitting out, I just, that doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
If I could also jump in here, I think two things. One, the commission could offer justification to the court based upon a narrowing of the definition of common vendor, and that is to say there are different fundraisers and media buyers have different information than political consultants, for example. And I think that that would hold some meaning for the court, because the coordinated regulations are designed to capture that sort of that communicative strategic messaging, and that certain common vendors just simply are never going to have that, regardless of the time frame that they're operating in. So that would be one way to go. And then the second thing is just to reiterate whether it's 120 days or 60 days or even a month out, if I were to sit down with a consultant and say, look, this is really what we want to, this is the messaging that we want to do, that's unlikely to be effective, for the campaign, even if that were something that we did. And so I don't know how successful you're going to be with the court, and I think the court is difficult to satisfy with these time windows and the justifications. But at least splitting the common vendors and narrowing that category may be something different, and it would have a basis that may have some meaning for the court.
Another thought that was helpful to me that came out of this morning's testimony was the idea that there is a difference between, you know, appropriating an asset of a committee, you know, taking a list or something that, you know, is property of the committee that, you know, a typical former employee would not permissibly walk out the door with, and then what knowledge is retained in their brain. And I think that if you walk out with an asset, that's a whole nother issue. You know, you have a whole separate problem. But the information that's retained in someone's brain over a period of 4 months, I don't think that's quite that useful anymore.
One of my one thought I had with respect to that scenario is it's not a, you know, you can't always assume that it's sort of a theft scenario. It might be that that's actually a good relationship and somebody is going to pursue something else and taking a list with them. But I do think the lists present sort of another issue is, you know, you might have a list of potential supporters, and so you might know who to send the mailing, you know, who to identify, who might be interested in this particular communication. But of course, if you don't have the campaign's current messaging and targeting information, the strategic information that you were just talking about, it seems to me that the list of who cares about this particular campaign is not relevant in and of it by itself. That there must be some other strategic information about that would go into a communication to therefore make it in some way coordinated, I think, is what the court was after. So if you could perhaps speak to that, that would be helpful. Because I don't think we can assume that it's that these assets, while they are certainly assets that are protected by any good campaign organization, it may not always be the case that someone did it in an unauthorized way.
You know, even since I think it may also be helpful, even since the time that the 120-day time frame was crafted, the speed at which and the various methods of communicating for campaign have increased so dramatically that even in that narrow time frame that they've been in existence, the speed at which a campaign will evolve and the tactics change and the strategy changes and, you know, what someone does on any given morning is going to perhaps change the way you're responding by the afternoon, much less a week later, that would support both a narrowing of the 120-day window in addition to a narrowing of the definition of common vendors. I'm not sure that there's empirical evidence that is going to be satisfactory to the court on that, but that is at least an approach that may yield some success.
I'll give you two examples of empirical examples of instantaneous changes in campaigns where every piece of strategy went straight out the window, so that 120 days became light years.
And right. I understand we're always going to find sort of the outliers, and one of the challenges I think that the court has put before us, frankly, is some ways I strongly disagree with, is the court's assertion that some information may, I think we can always find the outliers, and that's not... That's the challenge. I think what we're trying to do is establish sort of where the bulk of it is and where we can reliably say that this is, you know, we are confident that we have experience to draw upon that says after a certain, time frame, this information simply isn't relevant and therefore can't be useful in a way to coordinate the communication that would therefore, evade the goals of the act, as the court said. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would argue that 120 days is way too long. And today's communications and the capabilities, it's way too long. It's too long a period because things can change instantaneously overnight. They can and they do.
One other idea, perhaps it would be helpful, and I don't have this information on hand, but to inquire as to how often candidates and campaigns do poll. I mean, certainly they poll much more often than 120 days. That the environment changes radically and drastically from time to time.
Certainly, and we may well want to revisit the polling regulation at some point in the future. Like I said, we have we put alternatives out there, and the court didn't say that 120 days wasn't permissible. It said we hadn't justified it. So if we want to use that, we're going to need a record to go back to the court with and explain ourselves. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
General Counsel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given the time limitations and the time of the day, I do want to thank the witnesses for the very helpful information that you've provided, but I will pass on the opportunity to ask questions. Thank you.
Anything from the staff director other than to remind us once again that Canada beat the U.S. in the gold medal hockey game?
I don't want to rub it in. That's fine.
Any further comments or questions from the commission?
Commissioner, I hate to do this. If you could indulge me on, I have two quick questions. The first, I thought of hearing some of the other questions and testimony over the meeting of the Wisconsin Right to Life test. When that opinion came down, I read it as an objective legal standard. The commission passed a reg, which then became sort of a subjective multi-factor balancing test, and it morphed into what seemed to be a reasonable person test where, as Mr. Karenkross alluded to, sort of a figure skating judge. You kind of, I kind of like this move, but not that move. Therefore, this ad crossed the line, but that ad didn't. And in fact, in the briefs in Citizens United, there were a number of briefs that actually transcribed and presented to the court actual commission deliberation on the use of the reg. And now we've been told by the Supreme Court you can't do this multi-factor balancing test, but yet now I still hear concern over what about this inclusion of the word reasonable and no reasonable interpretation. I think that's a legal standard. I'm wondering if we can go right down the row. Is it a legal standard? How do we know that? Or is it a question of fact where we sit up here and sort of factually decide whether we like an ad or not?
Well, I don't think that it is a question of fact. In fact, I think that factual inquiry is foreclosed by that decision, which is to say going outside the four corners of that ad and saying, okay, what is this, who talked to who about this, what is the time frame of the ad, what is the who else is mentioned in the ad, if anybody, is exactly that contextual analysis that goes to the intent of the speaker and perhaps the effect of the listener. I don't think that's avoidable if you treat it as anything other than a standard.
I think it is a legal question, certainly not one of fact. I mean, I think the important thing to look for is the nexus to the election. I think that's what was required by the court there. Not a looks like, feels like note when you see it, but, is there any other reasonable interpretation that one could come up with that would work? I mean, you're looking for the nexus to the election-related activity there.
I agree with Sean and Jessica.
Well, it's a legal standard, but it has to be applied to facts. The facts may be limited. The facts may be just what's in the four corners of the ad, but that's a fact. What it says is a fact. So it's a question of where do you look? Do you look at whether, do you look beyond those facts to things like, was it a competitive race? Answer, no. Court said that. But so it's a narrowing of the facts that are relevant to applying that legal standard. But it's ultimately, I mean, you have to look at what happened. That's a fact.
But I do want to say that I go back to another thing I said earlier. I do think the commission should articulate some higher threshold than just anybody deciding that they would just like to initiate a complaint in a full-scale investigation just because that's what people do with their opponents. And it's just part of the process now. It's part of the campaign. And I think that's really unfortunate.
My last question, and may seem odd, but it's something sort of that Ms. Mitchell sort of said about operating from a clean slate. Notwithstanding the Shays 3 court ruling that we have to go beyond magic words, given what the Supreme Court has said, really since Buckley, but for the sake of argument, let's say Wisconsin Right to Life since, and what the D.C. Circuit has said since, Emily's List, today in Unity 08, can we really go beyond magic words and still remain consistent with what the courts have said recently?
Well, I think you've put your finger on exactly the problem. In all candor, I think it'd be very difficult to do that. I think the appeal to vote test is very, very close to an express advocacy magic words test. I don't know. I think that's right. I think they're virtually indistinguishable, but there is perhaps daylight between them. I don't know what that would be, and I think it would be difficult to determine that based upon a straightforward objective view of the language of the ad. And if there's not a call for action that is saying, that is appealing for somebody to go vote, to go support in an election a candidate, it strikes me that you are going to be into the going down the path of some contextual analysis.
I agree. I think we have to go back to the fact that we started here with the word expenditure, and an expenditure plus coordination is what we're trying to regulate. So, if you remember that an expenditure is defined in part as for the purpose of influencing any election for federal office, not that happens to influence, that may influence, that with a certain person, interpreting it could influence, but for the purpose of influencing.
I think Shays 3 is incompatible with the Supreme Court's decision, and I think that it's incumbent upon the commission to approach this in a way that is not just narrowly designed to respond to Shays 3, because I think the decision is incompatible with the law as it has been articulated by the Supreme Court and by the other decisions that you've referenced. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Well, as I said earlier, I don't think there's any definitive ruling yet on coordinated speech and how far they can go in regulating it. Citizens United was independent speech. Court was clear about that. Wisconsin Right to Life was independent speech. I think you have to go back to Colorado Republican, but the second Colorado Republican before they even addressed coordinated speech. Whether that will turn out to be the same test or not, I don't think we have an answer to that question right now. But I don't think, as I said earlier, that means the commission shouldn't adopt the Wisconsin Right to Life test, because I think that as a matter of administrative procedure, that's the right test to be applied in this context, whether or not it's required by Constitution or not.
And if I could just add, the Shays 3 court post Wisconsin Right to Life reached out and asked the commission, does this apply here? And the plaintiffs, as you would expect, they are charging that the regs are too lax, said, well, no. But they at least said, well, it may apply in some coordinated communications context with other plaintiffs, sort of leaving the door open. The commission's response just said, well, no. And our coordinated communications rules are supported by the general guidelines of general finance principles that Justice Roberts is talking about, which strikes me as being inconsistent. Chief Justice Roberts was talking about general principles and he was narrowing significantly the scope of speech subject to regulation, and you are talking about a content standard that expands greatly the scope of regulated speech, I don't know how those are consistent. And if it's a general principle, then it applies outside of Wisconsin Right to Life, and it applies by the commission's own submission. It applies in this; those principles apply in this context.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence.
Commissioner Weintraub?
If I might, because I think this is actually kind of important, and I don't think we'll resolve it here today, but Mr. Cancross, you said that you thought that the Wisconsin Right to Life test, there's like very little daylight between that and magic words express advocacy, but I was actually surprised when I read CU, the Citizens United case, at the way that the court analyzed the movie. I mean, it said... in light of historical footage, interviews with persons critical of her, and voiceover narration, the film would be understood by most viewers as an extended criticism of Senator Clinton's character and her fitness for the office of the presidency. That's not magic words. That's not close to magic words.
But the court made that analysis, Commissioner, in the context of a case saying that this restriction on that speech is unconstitutional, and that... and that an attempt to do so doesn't comport with the First Amendment.
But what it could have done easily would have been to say, and we want to reiterate what people have been saying since Buckley. All those people who thought that we were saying something else in Buckley, let's make it very clear. Nothing besides magic words can be regulated. This isn't magic words, full stop, we're done. And it didn't do that.
Sure, and it may be the case that we won't resolve it here today. But I would say the court's language is
I feel
important.
Confident of that much.
the court's language is important, and that it was talking in the context of expenditure. And expenditure does go back to Buckley. And expenditure was defined as for the purpose of influencing a federal election in the context of express advocacy and magic words. So I think it's important to read that being sensitive to the court's language as a whole, in Citizens United.
I guess I'll just you look you've got that frown look on your face, Mr. Trister. So I'll give you the last word on that. I mean, do you see this as the no daylight between, or is there actually a real difference between the functional equivalent of express advocacy and magic words express advocacy?
Yeah, I think there is. I think the court intended there to be. I think Wisconsin Right to Life, express advocacy meaning magic words. I think the harder question is whether there's any difference between your Wisconsin Right to Life standard and your Part B of your regulation. But that's not what you're asking me, I don't think.
No, I'm purposely avoiding the Part B question.
Okay, all right. Good. We should all avoid it. But in any event, I think the magic words part of it, I think, is it was quite clearly intended. I think in Citizens United, I don't think the commission argued that there was express advocacy. They did not argue that. They argued it was it was an appeal to vote, a functional equivalent. And I think there are differences. It opens up certain kinds of language, certain kinds of references that are not magic words, and that was what Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito said in Wisconsin Right to Life. They were not ready to say only magic words, and they think there's a difference, and time will tell, but I think there's definitely a difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the indulgence.
Any further comments or questions? Well, as with our first panel, I want to thank the witnesses we've had on our second panel. I think that this has been a very enlightening discussion. I certainly appreciate your preparation in terms and your availability for being here, for testifying, for answering the all the questions that we had coming at you, and even being on the overtime clock. You don't even look the least bit fatigued. So, again, thank you for being willing to be here, and this has been enormously helpful. This will conclude our hearing for today. We'll reconvene tomorrow at 10 o'clock to finish off. So for that, for now, we'll adjourn, and thanks once again.